Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, last week we lost Chancellor during the show. This week we got the tearing up of his economic plan, which resulted in the Prime Minister falling on her sword. What has changed? What hasn't? Did Jeremy Hunt go too far? And what does it all mean for your money? Plus, it looks like the pension triple lock is here to stay. Is a house price crash on its way? And how do you work out how much energy stuff uses to run? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, so in the space of a week, we've lost a Chancellor, a Prime Minister, an entire economic plan, and our national dignity. I think we were losing that before, though, to be fair. Jeremy Hunt came in to rip up his predecessor's mini-budget in one of the most astonishing about-turns in political history. Changes to the energy price guarantee, income, corporation and dividend tax, IR35 and tax-free shopping, but stamp duty and national insurance remain unaffected for now. How have the markets reacted? What is happening to mortgage rates? And what does this mean for our money? Simon, dare I ask, your appraisal of the week that was?
Well, Monday seems like a long time ago. We're recording this on Friday, and Monday definitely seems like a long time ago. But we got the news that Jeremy Hunt was going to be making an emergency statement. So we sat there with the TV on in the office, ready to listen. What was he going to do? What was the damage going to be? And then he didn't make an emergency statement. He just put out a video of him being recorded, ripping up Kwasi Kwarteng's tax-cutting plans. And I must admit, as I sat there and watched the stern teacher that is Jeremy Hunt dishing out the punishment that we all deserved after the 3 weeks of chaos that were not our fault at all, but somebody else's, I did think, I kind of preferred it when that nice Kwasi man was trying to give us all money rather than this teacher who's telling us all off for being naughty and taking it away. And I did think we have now done an entire circle, all pretty much back to where we started, apart from a somewhat meaningless cut to stamp duty and the spiking of the national insurance hike, which was going to happen anyway. And for what? Weeks of absolute carnage and an extra percent and a half on people's mortgage rates that's going to cause them a huge amount of pain. And also, which we're going to talk about in a minute, he tore up the energy price guarantee. I mean, the one thing that over the past 3 weeks we thought, well, at least we don't have to worry about that, was the fact that Liz Truss had locked in our energy bills for two years with a cap of £2,500. Now that's going to be torn up in April, and we're going to have targeted measures. And we all know what targeted means for the likes of us. Targeted means you ain't getting it. So I personally think, and we, again, as I said, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, that was a bit of a mistake looking at the winter that we've got and the problems that we've got. But honestly, you just look at it and it's almost unbelievable. But it was definitely a case of, here's what you could have won.
Yeah, it just gets more and more surreal. Helen, what did you make of it? What stood out for you?
I mean, I'm very tired, Georgie.
We're all tired, Helen.
It's been such a long week. And I just feel like how long has it been since Liz Truss came in?
45 days.
I mean, yeah. What a waste of time. The whole thing has just been an absolute waste of energy, of time. Like it's absolutely ridiculous. I think.
And then the 5 weeks before of the leadership nonsense, and then we got another week of that. Oh my word.
Yeah, I can't. I think that the one thing that stood out for me, which kind of illustrates how ridiculous this has all been, is when Liz Truss was doing her little goodbye speech. One of the achievements she listed, achievements in air quotes, was that she'd brought in the energy price cap. It's been so bad that something that she's basically just scrapped. So it was going to be capped for 2 years, and it's now 6 months. She said that, listen, that's her biggest achievement. I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, you've just cut it. It's bizarre and insane, and I've had enough.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so let's talk about then the things that are going to stay. And to a degree, the energy price guarantee will stay, but for 6 months, Helen. Then there's talk about the energy price caps perhaps going to £4,500. Who knows what's going to happen there? So other things that are going to stick as well, the stamp duty and the national insurance. Tell me more.
Yeah, so the stamp duty thing is staying, which is good. You know, homeowners, home buyers hate stamp duty, and it's a very sort of politically popular thing to do to cut that. You know, national insurance as well, obviously welcome for that to remain. But, you know, these don't make a huge difference to people's pockets. What's really going to make a difference is having massive energy bills and your mortgage rate really going up. So, you know, this is not a sort of net gain for the average person. You know, people are going to be really hit in the pocket by all of this. And I think the U-turns, I mean, it's only been a few days, but they don't seem to have yet had the desired effect, which might have been to sort of see mortgage rates, for example, stop going up quite so quickly. That hasn't really happened. They seem to still be rising.
Exactly. If you take a look at the stamp duty cut, for example, will save people on average £2,500. First time buyers a little bit more, because the threshold at which you start paying will go up for first time buyers from 300,000 to 425,000. For everyone else, it's 125,000 to 250,000. But with mortgage rates going up, it's sort of a little bit pointless, isn't it? But as you say, we don't like it. Simon, Helen there spoke about mortgage rates. Doesn't seem to have impacted yet. Markets, has it impacted there? I imagine with things like mortgage rates, with such uncertainty, and when you're thinking about, as a lender, fixed prices, you have to take into consideration now and you have to take into consideration future. But with everything so uncertain, if you can have an about turn like we saw on Monday, well, nothing's off the table, is it?
No, it's not. And this is one of the issues in the mortgage market at the moment, is it's not just about the expectation of higher interest rates in the future, but it is about the expectation of higher interest rates in the future. After the mini budget, there was an expectation that interest rates were going to have to go up by more, because the Bank of England is involved in tightening monetary policy, and Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss were involved in loosening fiscal policy. And as we said, that's like one of those driving instructor cars where you've got two sets of pedals and you've got one person sitting in one seat pressing the accelerator and the other person sitting in the other seat pressing the brake. Doesn't really work. You need both people to be working in tandem. So we had the fallout from that, which was then also triggered by the fact that these tax cuts were unfunded. And when we say unfunded, what does that mean? There was no obvious way that we were going to pay for these. So if you are going to do that, then you have to issue more debt in order to cover your spending. So there was the expectation that the UK was going to issue a load more debt. The market said, you know what, actually, if you're going to issue all this extra debt, things have changed. We want to be paid more interest on that. So there came in this expectation that interest rates would have to jump. Then also gilt yields jumped as well. Mortgage lenders looked at this, looked at the uncertainty and said, we're going to have to reprice these mortgages higher. So you had this, all of those mortgages being pulled in that week, the initial repricing, things are steadied, the ship has steadied, maybe interest rates aren't going to have to go up as high as we thought. A load of that stuff has been rowed back on. Gilt yields have pretty much stabilized. Roughly, they're where they were a month ago. Okay, we've seen the spike, they come back down. They're moving around, but they're moving around more within the realms of normal gilt movements rather than the wild swings that we were seeing. So why aren't banks and building societies, which, let's face it, have got a fair amount of cash, are eager to lend and want to make a profit, out there cutting mortgage rates for people? The answer is because they don't want to get caught out, and they'd rather sit on their hands for a while, let the dust settle. And also they're trying to manage the flow of business, because if you suddenly cut your rates while everybody else is raising theirs or staying at a high level, you know, we've gone above the average rates above 6% on 2 and 5 year fixes. You know, say Bank A, which has got plenty of cash, knows it can fund it, it's happy to take the risk, etc., suddenly comes in and goes, do you know what, actually, I reckon this is fine. I'm going to take rates down to 4.5%. You're going to see a massive influx of business, and it's going to cause chaos for that bank and that building society. And bear in mind that these guys have memories that stretch as far back as the mortgage holiday chaos that they all suffered when the mortgage holiday stuff was announced for COVID. So they're like, okay, yeah, we don't want to have that kind of chaos. It just doesn't look good for us. And we're happy to just sit back. I think the important thing to ask is, what does that mean, you know, for the next 3 months? What does that mean come January? That kind of thing. And maybe come January, you might start to find that they are a bit more confident about bringing rates down, but you just don't know. And so that's the impossible position that people who have to get a mortgage now because they're either buying a property or they need to remortgage are being put in, is they're having to take this sort of gamble on interest rates that most people are just not set up to be able to do, be that financially or, you know, in terms of processing all the information. And quite frankly, I don't think anybody is, because I don't really think that central bankers or banks actually have any idea what's really going to happen either. So the fact that we're asking lots of people to make this decision that's going to impact their finances for the next 2 or 5 years is really, really unfair, which brings me on to the energy price guarantee stuff.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But do you know what, Helen, I was driving as I was, having picked up the new keys to my rental property, which, I'll be honest with you, Helen, I didn't want to rent again. I wanted to buy. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate the short turnaround wouldn't have happened, but I was in the process. I was speaking to a mortgage broker and all of this stuff happened and I pulled the plug on it for the time being. And I think, all right, it's not a huge loss for me and my personal circumstances, but it has affected my life. And it just really struck me that what's happened over the last 3 weeks has impacted on people's lives financially, of course, but decisions in the future. It is so disruptive.
Yeah, of course. If I had been in a position where I'd had to remortgage or I was about to buy a house in the last few weeks, I'd be absolutely furious. Furious at the government. I mean, you know, a lot of people would have been in a situation like you where it was sort of early stages and they could sort of decide to maybe put things off while they see where the sort of dust settles. But people who were in the middle of buying a house or who had a remortgage deadline coming up had no choice but to go in on these really high rates and to fix that for 2 or 5 years. I mean, it's a terrible situation to be in. And you know, okay, interest rates were going up anyway because of inflation and the base rate, but the last few weeks have made it much, much worse. I mean, I think rates on the average mortgage have gone up by at least 1%, if not more, in just the last couple of weeks. And you're right, this is people's real lives. This is people's mortgage payments every month. And, you know, it's not right that the government could just make these kind of decisions on a whim. You know, remember, they didn't really go through the right kind of process to even make these. They didn't, you know, get the OBR to report on it. And it's, yeah, you're right, it's affected people's lives and it's not on. And I think it would be really interesting to see where this brings us to at the next election, you know, whenever that might be, you know, in 2 weeks.
Interesting. Understatement.
I really don't know. But, you know, the Conservatives have really annoyed homeowners, and that's not good for their voter base.
Indeed, they have. I don't think it's just homeowners they've annoyed, though, to be fair. Simon, we haven't really mentioned the things that are changing. Things like corporation tax, income tax, dividend tax, IR35, tax-free shopping. Not really that interested in tax-free shopping, if I'm totally honest, but what do you make of all of that? Stuff that was supposed to a degree, perhaps not income, but help business, which I thought was quite a crux for the Tory party.
We're sort of just going back to where we were, really. Some of those policies are problematic. Some of them aren't. Some of them are okay, but sort of problematic. Corporation tax, I don't honestly, genuinely think that that's a major issue. Okay, that is a substantial tax rise. And that was the first of the U-turns, right? But there wasn't really that much of a clamour from business for corporation tax to be lowered. You know, I think that the better lever to pull in terms of lowering tax is encouraging businesses to invest and giving them the tax breaks to invest rather than actually lowering the level of tax. And that's generally, you know, considered a wiser way of doing things. I don't think we needed to bring corporation tax down that low. Maybe we didn't need to put it back up to as high as we're going to take it up to, the 25%. Maybe we could have hit middle ground. But I generally don't think the corporation tax is the major issue. And actually, smaller businesses and entrepreneurs benefit from a better deal on corporation tax anyway. IR35 is not necessarily... I'm going to be careful what I say here, because there's going to be loads of people listening to the podcast who are contractors and who get really annoyed with me because this happens all the time. It's not necessarily a bad thing to be making it that people who are effectively employed by a company, i.e. they are just working for that one company, they're not really contracting for a number of different companies or doing a number of different jobs a year. They're doing really, really long-term gigs, which is effectively employment and is being used by the employer. Employers, bear in mind, in many cases, pushed people into doing this, or the employee as a way of just paying a much lower rate of tax rather than being employed. It's not necessarily a bad thing to try and stop that, okay? But the way it's been done just doesn't work properly. It puts the onus on the company, not the individual, to make the decision. It's led to loads and loads of problems. It's led to loads and loads of contractors being treated very unfairly. It's led to the pendulum swinging about wildly from companies and organizations pushing people into contracting and into weird schemes. Mm. And actually, the public sector was one of the worst villains in this. And that was cracked down on first, into all of a sudden, like swinging wildly back the other way and saying to people who genuinely are contractors, genuinely do work for lots of different people, who are actually abiding by all the rules, saying to them, well, sorry, you can't work for us unless we put you on PAYE. And that's totally wrong. So there is definitely a better answer than the one that is there at the moment, maybe ripping up the rules completely, as Kwasi Kwarteng indicated he was going to do. Wasn't it, but I don't know. It's a very complicated issue. So, you know, and then the basic rate of tax, did we need to cut it to 19p? I don't think we really did, to be honest. I think the 20p rate of tax is okay. I think if we're going to be entirely honest, we need to broaden the tax base and raise more tax, not be cutting the basic rate of tax, if we expect the public services that we expect. What else was there that we've
dividend.
Lost dividends. Now there, I think people are being treated unfairly. Dividend tax rates went up, and in return for that, people got the tax-free dividend allowance. But that was then hacked back to go after people paying themselves in dividends in order to avoid paying income tax. But that's totally missed all of the saver, the investors, right, who rely on those dividends. And there are people who have invested, you know, some invest in their pension, some invest in their ISA, but some have invested outside of it, and they rely on that income from those dividends. And they've been quite unfairly caught out by this situation. And they faced a rise in the tax on dividends commensurate with the national insurance hike. The national insurance hike has been cancelled, but the tax on dividends is still going up. So I do think that is a little bit unfair.
All right, then. So, I mean, in sum, Simon, if you don't mind, what are we going to get on October the 31st with the Chancellor's fiscal statement? I mean, anything new?
Don't know. Don't know if it's even going to be on October the 31st.
I mean, you don't know anything at the moment, but...
No, I don't think they should do it on October the 31st. I think it'd be crazy. Even if they managed to actually do this thing of coming up with a new prime minister in a week, that prime minister is going to be... 1 week's time from now is the Friday before the 31st of October.
Yeah. Well,
you can't have a new prime minister come in.
He knows
in,
the ropes. No.
You know, and then the chancellor, lay out this fiscal plan. That doesn't work. That's clearly, I mean, it's blindingly obvious that the two of them haven't worked together on it. They can't possibly have worked together properly on it. They can't possibly have thought it through properly. They can't possibly both be backing it in the same way. I think it's absolutely wrong to do it on October 31st and that they should push it back. Because if you want markets, this stuff about markets, you know, markets calling the shots, right? We're back. Great. We're back there. Woohoo. Yeah. I thought the aim after, you know, the financial crisis and austerity was to get ourselves to the point where markets didn't call the shots anymore. But we're back to the point where they do. If you want markets to take you seriously, then rushing out your fiscal statement after you've just swapped your prime minister because you decided that you still had the receipt for the old one and could take them back probably isn't a good move.
Yeah, which means it's going to happen, right?
Well, yeah, probably. We're not,
with good moves.
Probably. But yeah, I don't think that's a wise move. And actually, in all honesty, a sort of speculation about what that could bring. One other reason for pushing it back would be you push it back. We've only just had Jeremy Hunt reverse Kwasi Kwarteng's tax cuts. So we haven't really had the dust settle on that one yet. Let the dust settle. Let's see what's gonna happen, whether that's enough before we go barreling in to loads more measures. Because once we do those, we really need to try not to reverse them. Because this do things, reverse it plan, I don't think that's paying off that well.
No, nor I. Helen, though, wasn't the point of having the statement on the 31st of October was because I think it's the 3rd of November, the Bank of England make the decision on interest rates. And of course, we had inflation figures out this week, up a smidge, 9.9 to 10.1. So back where it was, I think, in July. What are we expecting from the Bank of England?
So I think the theory at the moment is it's going to be a bigger rise than they've done previously. Currently, people are saying 1% rise, which is huge. The most it's been previously has been 0.5%. So it's a big jump. But as you said, inflation is still going up. And the aim of all this is to kind of keep that under control. So yeah, it's a huge jump. It's quite unprecedented. But that's what people are saying at the moment.
One measure I should point out that, well, I mean, I think is here to stay, but who knows? This is the pension triple lock. That means the state pension should go up, Simon Lambert, by 10.1% next year, inflation, if the government sticks to its promise. And that is a big if. Although abandoning the triple lock would save an estimated £4 to £5 billion a year for the Treasury. It is very expensive. It looks likely it will stay this year. Is it likely to stay much longer? Or next year, I should say.
Well, I think after having junked it last year because the wage figures were skewed and then promised to stick by it this year, you've got to stick by it this year. You can't junk it. You can't then just change your mind on that as well. That would be really bad news. I know they've changed their mind on lots of things, right? But those were things that they'd only just announced and come up with. The triple lock is a long-standing thing. It's a cornerstone of the government's policy.
It's only about 12 years, though. I mean, that feels like a million years.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's long-standing.
But didn't they bring it in largely to, I mean, one, to protect pensioners, of course, but pensioners do tend to vote Tory more. So, it would seem a bit... But we may not have a Tory government for much longer. So who knows?
They brought it in because of pitiful state pension rises. They brought it in because, you know, they brought in this triple lock of inflation or wages, average wage growth, or 2.5% because of times when people were getting average wage growth and it was coming in at pennies, you know, pennies on the state pension. You know, this takes the full state pension for those who retired after April 2016 to £203.85 per week. That's £10,600 per year. That's not that much money. Our state pension is not very generous compared to many other countries. Now, some of these figures are skewed because other countries roll their employment pensions and their state pensions into one system, whereas we tend to have a broader sort of employment pension system on top of the state pension. But there are lots of people who rely very heavily on the state pension. And actually, yes, in percentage terms, it's a lot. In monetary terms, it isn't a lot. And pensioners, unlike most of the rest of us, don't have the ability to try to earn a bit more money, which is very hard to do, to be honest, to cover things going up. But that option is there for workers. It's not there for pensioners in many cases. The old basic state pension should rise to £156.20 per week, or £8,122 per year. Mm-hmm. Again, there was another system with that, state second pension, all that kind of stuff that bumps it up. But £8,000 a year is not a lot of money. So you do have to, I think, put it into monetary context. Should they change the triple lock? I mean, arguably, perhaps they should change the triple lock in some way. Maybe the formula needs to be changed. Certainly, it looked like something needed to be changed when we discovered last year that they were just relying on these average wage figures that had been skewed by the furlough and then the COVID recovery. I mean, but is it fair to change it to put in a cap on inflation? I mean, inflation really is 10%. That's not a figure there's no suggestion that that has been skewed by, any kind of weird statistical anomaly. The genuine inflation figure is 10%. And actually, there's plenty of evidence that that inflation figure undercooks inflation, and particularly because inflation affects different people differently. And those on lower incomes and those who are older, if you use one of those personalized inflation calculators, end up with a higher rate of inflation than many others. And we asked our readers, should Chancellor Jeremy Hunt stick with the state pension triple lock promise? And we had a resounding 93% vote for yes, and a 7% vote for no. And that was out of 1,840 people who voted.
Well, there we have it. This is many readers have spoken. Now, off the back of the pandemic property price boom, there's no shortage of forecasters predicting big falls in the near future. 12% by mid-2024, says Capital Economics. Credit Suisse, they go even further. They expect prices to fall by as much as 15%. However, you've been speaking to a man who correctly predicted the last two property crashes years before they happened. So, Helen, what does he think now? Who is this person?
Sure. So this is a piece that my colleague Ed Magnus wrote. It's really interesting. So it's a guy called Fred Harrison. He's a British author and kind of an economic commentator. We've spoken to him in the past. He has this theory, which is the 18-year property cycle theory. So this is based on hundreds of years worth of house price data. And he's kind of got this idea that property prices move in a certain way every 18 years, and then the cycle starts again. So given everything that's happened in the last few weeks and months, sort of rising inflation, rising mortgage rates, Ed decided to go back to him and ask him if that had changed his prediction, if that would kind of skew the cycle. And interestingly, he said it wasn't. He's sticking to his 18-year cycle, which means, he says, that house prices will keep going up until 2026. That's when they'll fall. Even in 2026, he said he doesn't want to call it a crash, it's not going to be a property crash, but he says at that point, the rate of increase will sort of slow. But he is sticking to his guns. It seems hard to believe on the surface of it, with people's budgets sort of being so squeezed, mortgage rates so high, that there won't be some kind of fall in house prices. Or if not a fall, at least a reduction of the sort of huge growth that we've seen in the last couple of years. I mean, the latest Palifax index for September showed 9.9% growth over the year. So, they've been going up a lot.
So even a drop by 12% by mid-2024 will probably not even get us back to where we were pre-pandemic.
Well, exactly. These sound like big figures that these analysts are coming out with, but you have to remember that house prices went up hugely during the pandemic. I think at some point it was knocking on 15% gains in a year. I mean, it's the British housing market, isn't it? It has an astounding level of resilience. If you think back to the start of the COVID pandemic, when people were forecasting huge falls in house prices, that didn't happen at all. They went up. The housing market in Britain has this kind of logic-defying level of resilience. I don't know, personally, I feel there's got to be some kind of falling off in the next couple of years if things kind of stay as they are with inflation, high bills and high mortgage rates. But it's really hard to call. You know, we've been wrong before.
Simon, call it?
No, I won't.
All right, moving on.
I think it's quite interesting that Fred has said this. And he said, what he said is that, you know, he thinks that there won't be a crash yet, but that the growth will tail off. We won't see the stupendous growth we've seen since the pandemic. And perhaps what happened in this like weird pandemic property boom thing is that we pulled forward some of the growth from the end of the cycle. And now, instead of seeing that acceleration at the end of the cycle, we saw the acceleration in the start of the final stage of the cycle, and then we're going to see it tail off, and then we're going to see it go down. But, you know, as I said, the pendulum swings one way, the pendulum swings the other. You very rarely see prices flatline. If they've been on a big upward rise, they tend to then either keep going up or start coming down. The sort of flatline is unusual, but, you know, if they went back to going up by 2 or 3% a year, they'd still be going up, and that would be, you know, relatively modest, but, you know, it would be rises and it wouldn't be a crash yet. I look at it and I think, I don't see how they couldn't fall. The cost of getting a mortgage, the cost of borrowing £200,000 on a mortgage was £800 a year ago, and it's £1,200 now, on the basis that most people's salaries have not gone up substantially over the past year. Gone up a bit, but not substantially. Not enough to cover that. They can probably still only afford about £800 a month, that buyer. And if you flip that around, previously their £800 a month would have bought them a £200,000 worth of mortgage. Now it will only buy them £130,000 worth of mortgage. It's the difference between being able to pay £270,000 for a home if you've got a roughly 25% deposit, or being able to pay £200,000 for a home if you've got that same £70,000 deposit. Definitely reduces people's purchasing power. Question is, obviously, what happens to mortgage rates from here on in? As I said, they could potentially come down. They could keep going up, could stick where they are. Who knows? Banks and building societies definitely have a couple of levers they could pull, though. And there's a big lever marked interest only that hasn't been pulled yet in this property cycle. That was the thing that triggered the insane 2000s boom, as banks and building societies realized that the repayment mortgages just wouldn't stretch people as far as they needed to, and started dishing out interest-only mortgages without checking there was any plan in place to pay them back. They haven't pulled that lever yet. Who knows? Maybe that lever might get pulled. Maybe that's the thing that keeps it going up before it all comes tumbling down.
All right, then, finally, as we brace for a difficult winter for millions of households who face far higher energy bills than this time last year, many will be looking at ways to make savings. So you have a simple formula to work out how much everyday devices add to your daily energy bill. Helen, before we get to some dads doing some extreme stuff, i.e. just not turning on the heating at all until their family frees, tell me more about this. A simple formula.
Sure. So obviously, almost everyone is trying to save money on their energy bills at the minute. Cut down their use is the easiest way to do that. But the thing is, certain appliances are more kind of worth your while trying to cut down on using than others. So the thing to do is to work out how much energy an appliance is using per hour, and then you kind of make a decision on where to potentially cut back, where you're going to save the most money by trying to cut down your use of certain devices. So this is an article written by my colleague Anne Carrick. She's basically described the calculation that you need to do. So whip out your calculator. And the way to work this out is to take the power rating for your device. So you should be able to find this quite often. It's it is written on the sort of device itself, or you can kind of Google it and find a sort of average for that type of device. You take that wattage and you multiply it by the number of hours that you use it per day, and then divide that number by 1,000 to get the daily kilowatt hour figure. So this kilowatt hour figure, that's the figure that tends to be sort of itemized on your energy bills. It's sometimes called units. So then you can work out how much the appliance costs to run. You're essentially multiplying that device's wattage by the number of hours you use it, and then by the cost of electricity. And that should give you a figure for how much it costs you. It sounds a bit complicated, but have a look at the article. Probably explains it a bit better than I've just explained it. It's quite easy to do, and it's a good way to kind of get some practical tips on how you could actually reduce your energy usage. You know, some things aren't going to be necessarily worth it. Other things might be worth it if they're going to save you, you know, kind of pounds rather than pence. So yeah, definitely worth having a look at.
Simon, what sort of energy saving dad are you?
I'm quite a bad energy saving dad, if I'm going to be entirely honest. I turn lights off. I've developed more of a habit of doing that. I've got a great energy saving trick, which involves the fact that we've got two controls for our heating in our house. And I just cannot work out how these things talk to each other. And every time I try to change the details on the thermostat, it looks like it's about to throw the whole caboodle out of the window. And so I stop, which means that I can't turn the temperature up. This sounds so bad, but I challenge anyone who's shaking their head at what a moron I am now to come around to my house and try and work it out. I can't turn the temperature up, so I can't get the heating to kick in. My wife knows how to do it. She spent a serious amount of time getting her head around this when we moved in, but so I can't turn my heating up. So that's good energy saving, I guess. I found this quite interesting, the how much power does something use. It's not something I really think about. I'm the kind of energy saving dad who, when he got a smart meter and got that little thing that tells you how much energy it's using, it sat on the side in the kitchen for approximately 12 hours before it got too annoying because it was plugged into the plug that we used to plug the phones into charge. So I unplugged it and then just put it on top of a cupboard where it stayed ever since. And God knows where that is. We've moved house since. But I did find it quite interesting. So it's like these numbers Helen was talking about, it does, as she said, it helps to read this. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/bills, where you'll find the article. But so if you had a 1500 watt air fryer, and these are the big thing at the moment, aren't they? Air fryers, very trendy. That
is anyone 1. Here got 5... one, by the way? Are they any good? Is it worth it? I'm just thinking it's sort of the next blueberries. You know, it's like it's the super food, super contraption that everyone's going to have. And the only winners here are the air fryer guys who sell them.
I'm skeptical. So my brother is very, very into cooking, and he is absolutely railing against the air fryer trend. So his girlfriend made them get one. You know, she jumped on the air fryer bandwagon, and he absolutely hates it. He said, chips come out rubbish. It's not a good, no. The word from the chefs and the foodies is no to the air fryers.
I was talking because okay, it's really good for small batches. If you've got a bigger batch of something, you're cooking, and actually it's not gonna make that much difference, is it? I don't know. If you're a single person, great.
I can back up Helen's brother here.
Yeah.
Is it your brother, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can back up Helen's brother from my brother as well. My brother used to be a chef, not chef anymore, but again, really good cook. And I said to him about it, and he said, yeah, it's not a fryer. You're thinking about it. He said they're badly named because they don't fry stuff properly. I mean, bear in mind, my brother came round to my house a while back, borrowed my camping stove so that he could go and deep fry stuff in his greenhouse because his partner said he couldn't be deep frying. I think he was doing like crispy squid or something, Chinese, like, you know, salt and pepper squid. She was like, you can't be doing that in the house anymore. It stinks the whole house out. So he came around, got my camping stove, set himself up some Breaking Bad style, you know, homemade Chinese food lab in his greenhouse. And yeah, he said the air fryer. No, it's not. You're thinking of it wrong. It's not for doing the kind of stuff that you want it for. But I mean, I think maybe it is good for, like, you know, maybe more cheaply cooking a chicken or something like that. But if you want it for the frying thing, and my understanding is it's not so good. Anyway,
sorry, I digress.
1500 watts, which is 1.5 kilowatts, okay, kilo, thousand, yeah, we all understand that. So for 1 hour, it would use 1.5 kilowatts. A kilowatt of electricity is capped at 34p at the moment on the price cap. So 1 hour of fryer would cost 1.5 times 34, which is 51p. Compare that to a slow cooker. They might be as low as 200 watts. So you take your 34p and you divide that by 5, because 1,000 divided by 200 is 5. So roughly 7p an hour to use your slow cooker. So there you go. That's how you work it out. Right. But no, to go back to your original.
A slow cooker for 1 hour, though. I mean, mine's on forever.
Well, I'm trying to explain easy to understand way. In the article, we have said if you use it for 5 hours, it would cost 34p. But that confuses people, because I was just talking about 34p, because that was the price of electricity. So I was just trying to make it easy.
I'm just saying. So I'm okay.
No, I'm a bad energy saving dad. I'm a terrible energy saving dad compared to Harry Wallop and Toby Wolm,
who tell me more.
Managed to both feature on This Is Money this week. Toby brilliantly had an article. It came from the Mail on Sunday. We also published it on This Is Money, where he calculated the cost of cooking a roast and various other things around the house. I went to my mum's house last Sunday. She said, "This Toby Wolm, he's an idiot." I was like, "That's funny, because I know Toby quite well." So that made me laugh. She said, "Look, he talked about the cost of cooking this roast chicken. And then he said about boiling the potatoes for half an hour." He said, "Why is he boiling the potatoes for half an hour? If he wants to save money, he should put them in the oven with the chicken." It's like, well, maybe he was parboiling them. She said, "Not for half an hour." And she said, "Also, if he wants to save money, don't parboil the potatoes. Just put them in the oven with the chicken." Which did make me laugh. And then we had Harry Wallop, who's refusing to turn his heating on despite his family sitting there shivering. And the great serendipitous thing about that, as with going around to my mom's house where she was telling me that Toby was an idiot, is that on Wednesday we published that article, and also on Wednesday I got the latest copy of Private Eye, which included the article "All Homes to Be Retrofitted with Dad. Despite refusing to conduct a public information campaign to reduce energy consumption over the winter months, the government confirmed today that it would be retrofitting every UK home with a dad. These dads are incredible devices for slashing energy consumption, spending their time walking around the house muttering, 'I'm not made of money, you know.' Their role will be to turn off lights in empty rooms, turn down radiators and thermostats, then switch off the heating after an hour, telling their children, 'It can go back on after I win the lottery,' said a government spokesman. Downing Street says that by retrofitting all UK homes with a dad for the winter months, we can slash the nation's energy usage by a third, thereby ensuring no rolling blackouts."
Yeah. It's a good point. My dad's heating broke down about this time last year. Do you know how long it took him to rectify that? It's still broken. It's still not on. So, Dad, please, you're getting on a bit. Can we get some heating on in your home? Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.